Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Time now to review the Sunday Papers. We are streaming live across our YouTube, Facebook, Twitter accounts, OTB Sports Radio and offtheball.com as well. And you can also get us on the Go Loud app. I have Cliona Foley of Off the Bench with me this morning and former Munster rugby player Dennis Hurley. Guys, thanks for joining us. I might as well go straight into the back pages because I think that is really the only place to start today. A lot of coverage, obviously, of Ireland's 46-14 defeat to the All Blacks yesterday at the Rugby World Cup. Sunday Times, first up, Black Knight. Ireland miss out on World Cup semis again after New Zealand thrashing. And the picture Robbie Henshaw looks on after the heavy defeat against New Zealand. And the sidebar as well, obviously, of note on the Sunday Times. Two-tier All-Ireland Senior Football Championship gets approval. So as of next year, on a three-year trial basis, there is going to be a two tiers of the All-Ireland Football Championship. More than 75% of delegates agreed to the change. And quotes from John Horan there. So they also decided eligibility for that Tier 1 and Tier 2 competition. It's going to be based on next season's National Football Leagues. So teams that finish in Division 3 or 4 next season will be going directly into the Tier 2 competition if they fail to get through to their provincial final next year. The back page of the Sunday Independent is a picture of Rory Best walking off the pitch in an Irish jersey for the final time. Down and out, merciless All Blacks put ragged Ireland to the sword. Brendan Fanning writing underneath that his opening line, if you accept that pretty much everything needs to go right in order to beat New Zealand, then you can paint the picture yourself when lots of things go wrong. That is after Ireland were hammered yesterday afternoon. And a teaser as well up at the top, Paul Kimmich, when is a positive test not a positive test? Very interesting piece on Jamie Heaslip's recent autobiography and the revelation, which he would have actually revealed a few years ago, but has gone into further detail on in his book about returning a positive doping test in 2014 before, or in 2006, before he was eventually cleared. But Paul Kimmage asked some very relevant questions, I think, and we'll discuss that later on. The back page of the Mail on Sunday, blackout. This picture is Conor Murray this time walking off the pitch, or just after Aaron Smith scores one of his tries yesterday. World Cup curse strikes again as latest knockout humiliation. Rampant Kiwis bring Schmidt's reign to an embarrassing end. Where until now as Farrell takes over aging, demoralised squad? They have plenty of reaction inside. Shane McGrath actually writes very, very well. And clearly, I think, without getting into hysterics over Ireland's campaign. And on the bottom as well, Ollie mocks Liverpool's 30-year drought. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has taken a cheeky dig at Liverpool ahead of today's big Premier League clash at Old Trafford by insisting Manchester United won't have to wait 30 years to become Premier League champions again. Who knows, we might be repeating that line in 25 years' time. On the back of the Sunday Mirror, rout of this world as the All Blacks celebrate one of their tries yesterday. Cup dreams die with Joe heartbroken, as Michael Scully writes from Tokyo, while they also lead with Ollie Cop title taunt, the same as in the Mail. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer saying it won't be 30 years before United are back lifting the Premier League title again. On the back page of the Sun, this picture is of Rory Best and Tadhg Furlong sitting on the bench in the closing stages of yesterday's game. All black and blue, humiliated Ireland are broken. Joe Schmidt admitted he was broken as his Ireland reign ended with a devastating defeat. And they also have a small piece at the top as well by Gordon Manning. GAA opts for two tiers on the two-tier football championship for 2020. And the last of the papers I have here, Sunday World, total blackout. It's lights out on Ireland's World Cup hopes in Japan. Ireland endured a soul-searching, or soul-scarring World Cup exit as Joe Schmidt departed to a somber, haunting drumbeat of a quarterfinal annihilation that might never mute, is what Roy Curtis says on the back of the Sunday World. And they also go as well with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's quotes on Manchester United and Liverpool this afternoon. So Cliona and Dennis, we have to start with the rugby, obviously. There are a couple of places we could go, really. There is, I suppose, first thoughts, Cliona, your general reaction on the coverage, because I thought that a lot of the writers had gone on pretty fair and were quite critical. When you came in this morning, you actually thought they hadn't really put the boot in as much.
Yeah, I would have said they haven't twisted the knife at all, and it's probably best represented.
So they've put the knife in, but they just haven't twisted it.
But they haven't twisted it, I think. And that probably comes as well because you're filing live on the day. But even, I said, as a measure, you can say Neil Francis said that he was too depressed to take out the scalpel, so people can judge it from that. So I would have said, yes, most people, you know, everybody said, played terrible all the rest. most abject. There's actually one of the most vicious lines you'll read today comes from New Zealand. It was interesting. The Daily Mail, the Mail on Sunday cleverly looked at the New Zealand papers and said what was the reaction. Mark Galler had a look at it, and Gregor Paul and the New Zealand Herald said
he doesn't hold back,
and this is probably this has turned the knife in. When New Zealand turn up with that difficult to strike balance of fire in the blood and ice in the brain, a team of limited old cart horses like Ireland never stood a chance. Now that's twisted the knife, but and we'll talk about maybe individually what people have said, but I do think that Shane McGrath's piece is as always, he's a beautiful writer, just very erudite, and so the writing in it is absolutely beautiful, but also, you know, the logic in it is very interesting and very clear-headed.
And I think actually the best thing about it is it's very easy on a day like this to get a bit hysterical with the writing, and I think it is very much putting the boot in. It's very critical, but it's not over the top. It's not cartoonish.
Like, the headline is "Hopeless, Clueless and Rudderless. Ireland got exactly what they deserved." And so his point is this, this notion of entitlement and deserved and how hard everybody works in sports, as Dennis knows as a pro, and he's saying, you know, deserve has nothing to do with elite professional sport. You can work as hard as you like, but, you know, when it comes down to it, there are things that have to happen. You have to be good enough. And so, you know, basically this is a measure of where we are. So in this environment, only the highest standards apply, and Ireland were hopelessly adrift of the level set by New Zealand. And then he looks at why he says it was poignant to see Best, you know, and Schmidt's, you know, careers end like this. But, you know, you have to take the emotion out of it and look at what happened and why it happened. And that probably, I think, will happen in more detail over the next few days as well. He makes some really interesting points. Like, he starts to go into the analysis. So he says the spread of players, good players, is too thin to absorb losses to injury and to allow for rotation. Their vulnerability was further exposed by the decision to carry Robbie Henshaw and Joey Carberry when neither was fully fit, so he's saying they shouldn't have been brought. They were too inconsistent and, as has been increasingly clear over the past 10 months, they're past their best. So he actually starts to look at some analysis of the team, but I think it's a piece well worth looking. And obviously one of the things is tactics need to be adjusted in a sport where the best teams have throughout the World Cup prioritised speed and accuracy over power and size. And he's saying Andy Farrell has that responsibility now. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
What have you made of the coverage, Dennis?
Yeah, I think in general, like, some of the stuff is just that deflation. You know, you can kind of get a sense of it through a lot of the writing. You know, a lot of it, I think, has it was almost ready to happen. You know, I was saying to you just before. Even through the warm-up games, we didn't see an Ireland that we saw in 2018 doing a Grand Slam, and that was a team that were full of confidence, just exuded. No matter who was hitting the field, there was accuracy, there was pre-planning moves, but it was the accuracy of that. So I just found that there will be more scathing reviews, I'm sure, during the week. Obviously, I think a lot of people are kind of trying to just get adjusting to the, you know, I suppose the disappointment of not making a semi-final, but
and there is a common theme, there isn't, Dennis, of us and Schmidt not adapting to the style of play that is successful at World Cups, as opposed to what works for you in the Six Nations. Mm. And Mick Galway, actually, who has a column in the Sunday World, I felt is actually very good on this.
The opening paragraphs, I think, sum it up very well.
Yeah, it's the saddest thing I've ever written, that with 20 minutes left in the Rugby World Cup quarterfinal in Tokyo last night, I was praying Ireland would score. I know, it does. But he has a very good line that, and you know, I think is probably the question that is going to be asked and has to be asked at this stage, if you're looking at World Cup success for future, is our total failure to make impact a World Cup down to IRFU's insistence that the national coach, whoever he is, prioritise the Six Nations each year, because that the national team and the Six Nations are the union's cash cow, and there has to be an interest in how we're going. So he's saying, like, everything, you know, he's basically saying everything has to work. Coaches have to do well in Six Nations, and I've always said Six Nations rugby is completely different. Now we can look at how can England have the ability to play both styles, but he does raise that very good question, and he's saying, and he does point out against the bravery of New Zealand, not physically, but in management, in completely changing their team. You know, the team that lost in Dublin, I know, was a friendly, but seven of them didn't start again, so they reconstructed their team. And so his argument is, you know, are we going to be controlled by Six Nations going forward and the way that game is played? and or else are you looking seriously at, you know, more expansive rugby?
I think the core point that even the two articles, like Shane McGrath and Golov, it's the predictability of the current game plan, and I think that was the biggest failure, you know, essentially of this World Cup for Ireland, because we probably weren't as primed and as effective as we have been previously in you know, when we've been at our best, I suppose. But even within that, we still have it's still a very predictable game plan. And I think what Mick is trying to refer to there is, like, we need to evolve that thought process. So we've kind of caught up, but we've now lost track on the global game, essentially, with the, I suppose, the top teams in the world. You know, going into the World Cup as number one was probably a little bit, you know, unrealistic. You know. Mm-hmm. To actually where we are, you know, we've dropped down the rankings. I'm not sure where we've dropped it. Maybe after losing to New Zealand, we're still fourth, or maybe we've dropped to fifth. I don't know. But I think that's probably going to be something that people are going to be looking at. And that reference, I think, to Andy Farrell and Mike Catt coming in is going to be the next stage of. Mm. How does that evolve?
Yeah, and on the game plan, Shane Horgan had a couple of good lines, speaking about how, like, Ireland did actually try to do a few more out there things yesterday, bringing in certain moves and power plays, and it was the basic errors, the handling and the timing of the runs that were just so off. And his point was that, you know, what is unfathomable, it was his faith in those that selected could implement the style needed to beat the All Blacks, having not attempted or executed a similar plan since that second test in Australia. What is unfathomable is that he should ask his team to play this way against the world champions when he hasn't been so demanding in fixtures against lower lights like Scotland. So he's kind of saying that, how can you actually expect them to go out there against the best team in the world and execute all these plays that you've been holding back when... Yeah. You haven't tested them out against other teams.
That's
when you
exactly
haven't,
right, yeah.
You know, surely it's against the in the games like that against Scotland where you're trying these things out.
Yeah, well, that's the whole argument about Schmidt, is that he is conservative when he needs to win a game. I always said, we were talking about that, I said, the game in Chicago against the All Blacks, Ireland played unbelievable rugby that day. But for me, he let them loose because... it wasn't a competitive match. There was nothing. There wasn't a title at thing. It was a completely different style of play. If you go back and you watch that game to what they normally play in Six Nations and here as well. And so, how can you expect players to have the skill, the judgment under pressure from one the greatest team ever, or, you know, the country with the nation with the greatest skills ever? Mm-hmm. How can you expect them to pull that off? So Shane McGrath's line as well is like. They've had a game plan. It's not an expansive game plan, or it's not an adventurous thing. Everybody is caught up with it and knows what it is. And worse, he says, Schmidt either didn't realise this or else blindly trusted it would somehow work in Japan. And, you know, the game against Japan, I think, immediately, exposed that notion that it was going to work. It wouldn't work against a team that's going to play like that.
And the problem then, it's too late to really change anything, isn't it?
Yeah, and there are, in several pieces today, they're making the argument, you know, okay, New Zealand could change the game and be brave and introduce new players because they have a level of depth and talent there that we don't have. You know, but at the same time, like, I've always felt Schmidt hasn't trusted in younger players coming through. And like Luke McGrath got on the field yesterday at 74 minutes, I think it was. The game was gone. There was
What impact can he make?
Why leave it so late to bring him in at that stage? You know, we knew the halfbacks weren't making any impact. Why not let him in earlier and see what happened? And, you know, a couple of people said it there. I mean, Larmour actually being on the field accidentally stopped a try at one stage, and like there was a big argument for starting Larmour, I think, yesterday as well, to be just that, but it's not Schmidt's mindset. And there is a very good, and it was obviously pre-written and then adjusted, but Brendan Fanning has a very good biog, if you like, of Joe Schmidt, starting from his arrival, actually how he was recruited and came to Mullingar all the way through to now. And just the one thing, like, the press have struggled with Schmidt because he micromanages everything and he's so careful about everything, including press matters and everything. And there's some very insightful things in that. The people who, if you like, you know, aren't close involved with the team or aren't involved in the media mightn't even realise. But I think that's well worth a read, that Fanning piece.
Page 2 and 3 of the Sunday Independent. And it even starts off like with the story about it was a Magners League, so probably just after Joe Schmidt had taken charge in 2010 or 11. Yeah. And he's on a flight home with all the hacks who had been well oiled from the sponsor's product the night before, and you know, he's talking about it was a particular journalist. Said man was in rag order. He smelled like a brewery with fag discarded in a gutter. He struggled on board and settled in beside Leinster's brand new coach. Seated directly behind, we were searching frantically for an alternative oxygen source. It was horrendous. And there was this guy, Joe Schmidt, smiling and listening and making out like he'd got the golden ticket to the best bus tour in Europe. And it just shows that probably Schmidt as a personality changed a lot in the last 7 or 8 years as well.
Yeah, or maybe that's, I mean, Dennis raised a very good question outside. He said he'd be really interested to see how Joe Schmidt would coach New Zealand.
Yeah.
Would he coach them dramatically different from how he coaches Ireland? And I believe he would.
Yeah.
And I think he would because he believes they have a higher skill level and would trust them with that skill level, if you like. Do you know?
But he seems to be very heavy on trust, so he... Like, essentially, I'd nearly look at that selection of Larmour versus Kearney. It's more of a trust of who is my best fullback? Who's that goalkeeper that I can kind of guarantee is going to cover those mistakes? We did see Rob making one great cover and tackle, you know, but in general, is he the type of player that's going to break up a game for you when there's not much creativity happening and things aren't working well? And that's probably the point, I think, through this, is like there hasn't been enough guys getting the opportunity more regularly, I think. You know, that's where, you know, in England, they kind of have their fixtures in place and they do introduce new individuals, but they get the opportunity to play in big games surrounded by, you know, some of the key international players. That makes it a much easier, I suppose, evolution for those individuals. But you got to put them into the big games.
You've got to get that big game experience.
So, like the games, like your game at England, home or away, you know, let's say France, home or away, you know, and Wales, home and away. Probably at the currently, they're the biggest fixtures we have in our calendar year. You know, because it's Six Nations, it's do or die kind of every game.
Yeah, and even if you look at the contrast with selection of New Zealand, the two wingers yesterday, Sevi Reese and George Bridge. George Bridge had, I think, two caps when Ireland would have played New Zealand last year. He wasn't even playing in that. Sevi Reese is only capped since the summer. And these are the two guys in for the start. 12 months ago, if you'd said Rico Ioane wasn't going to be in the match day 23, people would have laughed at you. He discarded Owen Franks before the tournament.
Yeah,
probably the best prop they've ever had.
Yeah, that's been mentioned.
Because he decided he wants guys who are better ball players.
Yeah.
And he said this is the right way to do it. And these are the decisions that are paying off
now. And Schmidt wants people who are solid defenders. And that's the reality. Like all the pieces, I feel like, as we said, they're not completely sticking the knife. And I think the more in-depth analysis will come up in the next few days. I thought there was one interesting piece as well from Jonathan Liu of the London Indy in the Irish.
We might just come to that after the break.
Sure.
We do have to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more of the pay-per-view with Cliona and Dennis afterwards.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
All right, welcome back to the Sunday Papers here on Off the Ball. Neil Tracy here with you until 7 o'clock this evening. Cliona Foley and Dennis Hurley alongside me reviewing the Sunday Papers. Cliona, before we went to the ads, you were just about to mention a Jonathan Liu piece, but in the last couple of minutes, Tommy Conlon's piece in the Sunday Independent, you want to bring up as well?
Yeah, well, again, another beautiful writer usually gets things spot on with his words. And, you know, we were just saying the reflection also, obviously all of this stuff reflects the fact that, yes, we were right. They had peaked a year too early. And Tommy Conlon's piece is lovely in that he talks about how fragile and transient is the lifestyle of a top team.
Yeah.
And especially if the essential replacement parts are not coming through to keep it revitalised. And he says if that was the case, he says few people wouldn't have gone probably to Japan. But his last line in this is really good as well. He said, the sheer speed of the implosion, this free fall into utter incoherence was a shock to behold. A generation of players who were idolised in their own country had their professional pride taken away from in the finish. Rarely has the end of an era in Irish sport seemed so inappropriate to the legacy of that era and so bereft of the standards that created it in the first place. It's a beautiful piece of writing and really sums up, I'd say, how a lot of people feel after watching that team yesterday, you know, understanding how great they were, what brilliant days they gave us, and then to see it all literally, you know, trickle away like that and sort of inappropriately as well for the great days it had given us. I just thought the Jonathan Liu piece was really interesting. As I said, it's in the Sunday Indo. It's a piece about talking and about how loud the English team are, and anybody who watched them yesterday in a brilliant performance.
Which, let's be honest, we're always quite critical that the English talk about too much, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah, do. And you look at them and they annoy the hell out of you sometimes. But he actually says this is a huge asset to them. And I noticed yesterday, I was saying again, even in the middle of that crisis, where were the Irish players? Who were the leaders who were going to pull them together at some point in that game and say, you know, because there are broken plays and a lot of broken, who was taking leadership, who was taking ownership and trying to rearrange things or talk about it. And you, if you watch England yesterday, and I mean, he says, has there ever been a noisier team than this England team and their management? And you mightn't like the way they go on about things and the way they use the kind of chest beating and the shouting and the roaring, but you can see that they use it, you know, they use it as a big factor psychologically, you know, in their progress at the moment. So it is, I think it's they're an interesting contrast, because he said that a couple of them, you know, Lancaster had said to one of them, you need to talk more. As a rugby player, you need to talk more. So again, that's an interesting observation, I think, and watching teams in the quarterfinals over the weekend.
As a player then, Dennis, obviously you're in a good position to tell us, like, how important is constant chatter out on the pitch?
If things go quiet, that's when you know things are, you're in trouble. You know, like, I'd say there was a little bit of shell shock. I think that point in a game that, because Joe's whole game plan, okay, he puts it into place, right, and he has specific ways he wants things done. He would have been hammering with the squad all week. We need to play, because I've heard Johnny Sexton and a few of the other senior leaders talking about playing New Zealand previously, and it's, we have to continue attacking them. We don't let the foot off. So that point and that decision when they had a penalty, 10-0 down, it was about the halfway line, and it's kickable, and they decide to go down the touchline. That's the one where
they picked it off the touchline.
Yeah, to keep it in play. I think that was a moment where kind of players are going, oh my god, like, how are we not getting the opportunity? Because that was a turning point. I felt just even the demeanour of players to kind of go, there's certain instances in a game, but a game like against New Zealand, those opportunities just don't fall that easily. That would have been a 7-pointer. I can guarantee, like, Ireland's lineout was 100%. You know, as much as people would have said, like, not bringing Dev Toner, was that going to be a factor? But the pickup from, you know, James Ryan, I think, especially, you know, calling the lineouts and really.
I suppose, the issues ran a hell of a lot deeper in the end than the lineouts.
There was probably a case of, you know, we're going to back our lineout, you know, let's go to the corner and let's use our drive maul, which has been so effective.
And the distance and the kick and the placement of the kick. The distance of it was brilliant, but it didn't go in deep enough. And next thing, Moana pulls it out of the... Like, it was an extraordinary piece of skill. And as you say, psychologically, what does that do to you?
Yeah, but you're not expecting it, because everyone sees the ball crossing the line, you know? And you're looking down the field and you just think, OK, all of a sudden the All Blacks are running back at you with the ball.
So not only have you missed touch, you actually thought you had touch as well.
It's
the double whammy.
Yeah, it's a double whammy, exactly.
And as a collective, you know, I mean, like, let's say Clive Woodward, he's in the Irish Mail, and he's just kind of talking about, like, his opening line is just never underestimate the value of momentum, you know. Like, he's talking in a bigger sphere, but in every game there's momentum, you know. Like, teams will always talk about, there's such fine margins, I think, in rugby, you know, being slightly offside, a penalty against you, and that's a kick, either a post or, you're giving away a line out 30, 40 metres closer to your own goal line. Like, there's so many factors of momentum in a game, and I think that was just one of those where Ireland just didn't get a foothold. If you look at games that are, the two games, I suppose, that Ireland have beaten New Zealand, it's they've got a foothold into the game. They've scored a try in the first 15, 20 minutes, and they're putting the All Blacks on the back foot. We didn't get to see that yesterday. So there was no shots fired in the first half, and, you know, when you go down in at halftime with that deficit, it's a very hard hill to climb back up, and especially then when things just aren't firing fluidly, like, and that momentum is just not there.
On the talking then, actually, as well, to flip it around even as well, Dennis, if things aren't going well for you in a particular game, and the other team, like England might have been doing yesterday, they're constant talking, they're constant slapping each other on the back.
Talking to the ref, talking to each other.
Talking to everyone.
Constantly talking.
Does that just get more and more frustrating then as well?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's what do you do? I mean, if you're senior team leaders on the field, you almost need to narrow down, okay, like things aren't going perfectly well, but what is the two key points that we can actually, you know, give the rest of the squad and we get behind, you know, and whether that's just being exact with our clear outs, like let's create quick ruck ball and let's play off that and see what happens. But the All Blacks, their defence was just so bloody strong, I suppose. They had this game targeted. I think once they knew the fixture from last weekend, they were, everything it was, Ireland had beaten us twice in the last three games. They think they're going to beat us. This is World Cup quarter final. And they just exuded that confidence in themselves and each other in to go and just strip Ireland of our best assets, you know, and just took away any opportunity of our running game. We had the lineup, but just their defence was just annihilated, I think, any bit of progression that we had up in attack.
It's a beware of poking the bear, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Any other pieces on the match itself yesterday before we move on to, I see you have Jamie slipping the Sunday Independent ready to go there, Cliona?
Yeah, the other thing we were just saying is that I often think that statistics are a joke.
Yeah.
And professional sport is obsessed with them now, and rugby is obsessed with them now. And very,
rugby's huge on them.
Rugby is massive on them. And, you know, people like Schmidt and that, so much is everything is analysed and parsed and everything. But you can't analyse and parse for a piece of genius like that, keeping the ball in field. You know what I mean? I was saying Owen Farrell's little pass yesterday, I think, was it the Sinclair try?
Yeah.
It was just extraordinary piece of skill. He had a tiny, tiny, tiny margin. The speed, the weighting, everything was perfect. You can't analyse that for, you know, that's skill and that's decision making under pressure. That's all those things. The match stats are extraordinary for our game yesterday and equally extraordinary for England, Australia. We had 50% of possession, right? We won our scrums and lineouts all 100%. That kind of thing, you know, you say possession, territory, all that stuff, set pieces, all really level and equal. But then you come down to turnovers and even penalties. We only conceded, and that was always one of the things Joe sings, don't concede penalties. 6 penalties to 12.
But we conceded 6, they conceded 12.
But turnovers is the one.
Yeah.
There's one statistic here that's relevant, and that's turnovers, 9-17. So we conceded 17. And clean breaks, line breaks, clean offloads, and they're the statistics that matter. New Zealand, 13 clean breaks, Ireland 2. Offloads, 16, New Zealand, Ireland 2. So sometimes statistics, I think these things about, you know, possession and territory and all that kind of stuff, it's nonsense. It's the other detailed ones. And look, we know we've been arguing that we don't offload the ball enough for years. These are the statistics that matter. But it's funny, if you look at the England Australian ones, they're very similar. Australia's stats are very, very good.
Yeah.
Look at the scoreline.
Dominated possession.
Dominated possession. Look at the scoreline. Look what happened in the few key moments.
Right, so do you want to move on to Jamie Heaslip, Paul Kimmage, Cliona?
Yeah, I'm particularly interested in this case, and I do think people will probably, Paul Kimmage obviously is a person who, you know, would be always jumping on anything that has to do with a positive doping test at any stage.
I might just give the background of it. So basically, Jamie Heaslip, this is an extract Paul Kimmage has published here from the Sunday Times in 2014. So Jamie Heaslip has revealed for the first time he failed a regulation doping test in the summer of 2006. He was 22, returning home from Dublin to start his first full season with Leinster. And he has elaborated on now again in his recent autobiography, All In, I think it's called. Heaslip's testosterone level was above the stipulated 4-to-1 testosterone to epitestosterone ratio. His previous tests were also found to contain consistently high levels of natural testosterone, a physiological anomaly confirmed by further testing. And the quote, "I honestly feel it has played a part in keeping me fit," Heaslip says. "I've always recovered quickly, and another small advantage, I rarely get hangovers," is what he says. So Paul Kimmage is looking at that. He is looking at what Jamie Heaslip has said about it in his autobiography, and he's looking specifically about how Jamie Heaslip was informed about this by the Irish Sports Council
what
at the time
was.
And what the procedure was after the test had returned positive, and how it reached a point where Jamie Heaslip was cleared. And he's comparing it to a case involving
Gareth Turnbull. Irish middle distance runner.
So Turnbull had arrived home when the van from DHL arrived. First of all, he got a call. He got a call from Una May, the head of the anti-doping at the Irish Sports Council. "Can I confirm I'm talking to Gareth Turnbull?" He recalls her asking. "Yes, you are," I said. "I'm just notifying you to say you've given a positive test and we'll have the details in an hour." So he was eventually delivered the test and was required to present himself to a tribunal 10 days later. And he eventually argued the
successfully argued his case,
was eventually cleared. Yeah. So
I'm really interested in this case, and I remember reading David Walsh wrote a really good interview with Jamie Heaslip, and that's where that quote comes from in 2014. And I remember it jumped off the page at me, and I said, hold on, Jamie Heaslip actually had a positive test for testosterone, but actually then they turned out that his body naturally produces a lot of it, and that's okay. But my question was, because I covered track and field for so long, was how was this handled? How do we never hear of it before? Because what happened, and also who was involved in all of this? And in the book now, he's saying that he explains how it happened and when it happened and who figured it all out. Mm-hmm. But to me, how it was handled is very contrary to how an Irish athlete normally gets treated if they fail a drugs test. And even the point of Gareth Turnbull's case is a great example, okay, because he also had a high testosterone level. He had to contest it. When you contest under the Irish anti-doping rules, if you got a positive dope test in the morning and you're an IRFU athlete, under normal circumstances, my understanding of our system is that when you go to argue your case, you don't have the support of the IRFU. If you're in athletics, you don't. They actually, the case technically is taken by Irish Athletics against you. Because I know Irish athletes who go, the Athletics Ireland never gave me any support. And I said, well, technically they can't, because the system is that they're taking the case. So they go to the tribunal to take the case against you and you have to defend yourself. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was really interesting at the time. And it raised the issue for me that, does an athlete who fails a test in a professional team sport, do they have completely different support system than somebody who's an individual in another sport? Mm. And that's how it looks to me, and that's how it reads to me, and that's why Kimmage is questioning it. And he has asked the Sports Council to clarify Heaslip's explanation of it exactly what happened. Mm. They're saying actually no.
Yeah.
They're not saying what happened, but they are saying to Kimmage, they're saying the actual quote is we have you asked him about it, because what he's saying is not our experience of what may have happened.
Yeah.
They're not saying anything is wrong here, and let me clarify that. Yeah. They're just saying that they think that Heaslip's version of events, they're saying, is not actual, but they won't say what they are. And then he's also asked Heaslip and Matt Cooper, who worked with him on the book, could you clarify exactly? And he hasn't had any response to that. I just think it's a very interesting case, because I know that Gareth Turnbull at the time, it cost him $100,000 to defend himself. And then he looked for that 100,000 and I think struggled to get it. And then the Irish Sports Council relented and did pay him his costs. But it was a very, very difficult time in his life.
That was his legal costs for
the case. It was legal costs for contesting the case.
It wasn't like grants or anything.
No, that was his legal costs. He had to pay legal costs, 100,000, to defend that case. And actually, as it turned out, get cleared of the accusation. His argument was that he'd been drinking very heavily the night before and that had raised it. And medically, he was able to prove that in the end. But I just think it's an interesting, this has been an interesting case for me, because I often wondered, does a rugby player, do they get treated differently than a track athlete or a cyclist or somebody in, you know, an individual? Is there a different support system for them? And even is there, because we know that even the testing systems are slightly, like, I asked Dennis this morning, were you ever tested at home? And he said, no, only people who'd be on the international panel would be on that panel that could be tested out of competition.
For a certain window of time.
Out of competition for a certain window of time.
Whereas
anybody who gets any kind of money from in athletics, you can be tested at any time and you have to give your whereabouts 24 hours, 24/7, 12 months a year, whatever. So I just think, are there anomalies in our, is the system equitable? And does the Jamie Heaslip case, does that tell us anything about the system? And also, was his memory of it? Why are the sports council saying, well, actually, that isn't exactly what happened? So I think it's worth asking the question.
Yeah.
And I think anybody who is involved in anti-doping in Ireland or gets tested would be interested in this, some clarification around
this
case.
Yeah, and it could be something as simple as Jamie Heaslip has just kind of got the fine details of the whole process.
Yeah, he just may have got it mixed up exactly. But I think anybody who is would be interested in the case, because I was interested in the case because at the time, for me as a journalist, if an athlete failed a test, we're not meant to know, obviously, clearly, and the Sports Council will never identify it until the case is finished, and that could be 2 years' time.
Yeah.
But I was interested at the time when he said they checked, then they checked me medically, then they discovered I was fine. But he was never brought to any tribunal. None of that happened in his case. And I just thought that was really interesting at the time. And I wondered what the differences were in the cases. So there's absolutely, no indication that anything wrong was done.
Yeah,
I just wondered,
100%.
Is there a different system when it comes to team sport?
Because I often
wonder about that with professional soccer in Europe, and professional rugby worldwide. Are they tested as deeply? And if they fail a test, do they have more support systems than an individual in individual sport?
Would it ever have been explained to you by Munster Rugby or the IRFU that if someone had returned a positive test, what the protocol would have been?
They would have. Not in great detail, I think, but you kind of are on your own, essentially. Because if you fail a drugs test, like you're let's say contract wise, you're void, you've null and voided your contract essentially. So you now have to prove that the test is false, or that there is other mitigating circumstances, with your own makeup and stuff like that, like Jamie was talking about.
It was his physiology, exactly. What happens with track and field because I know particularly well is you would be suspended during the period of your appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was often curious to hear how did that all happen so quickly? Was there a suspension? There doesn't seem to be a suspension. How long did it happen before he was discovered this physiologically that he had this natural asset and whatever? They're the things that I wonder about, because that's interesting. Your understanding is you would have to defend for yourself.
Well, you would, but probably the bigger difference is that we would have had a full-time medical, appointed director, who had kind of responsibility, I suppose, and kind of the overseeing of, duty of care, I suppose, to all our athletes, which may the individual athletes may not necessarily have. So there's kind of,
there is a bit of
a buffer point there.
Yes.
Definitely there's the clarity about the whole structure and the system, and it goes bigger, it goes even to WADA. There's a lot of holes, I think, in their whole system. There have been even other professional rugby players, let's say, who've been supplied a product, by
someone with a supplement. Yeah,
by their own strength and conditioning coach, but it's been sanctioned by the union or the club. But they are the ones that get the automatic ban. So someone might take some, it could be a caffeine substance
accidentally. Yeah.
And that's not illegal, but it's just the case. There might be some little additive in there, in a batch that's wrong, but all the blame falls on that individual
player.
That's
right. You're responsible for what's in your body.
There's a whole overarching, on the whole policy and the structure of exactly how it's applied, because if someone blatantly goes and takes something for their own personal betterment, that is where the real issue is. I think there's kind of, yes, there should be a slap on the wrist for someone who's caught with something, but if they can prove that it wasn't kind of not through their own direct, they didn't go and seek to try and take something, and that there's someone else might be kind of culpable in a system. So, and that's kind of like sponsorship. So if you're sponsored by
various supplement companies, a lot of athletes would have deals with.
There might be just one batch, and you as an individual could get pulled on a drug test.
The thing that interested me at the time, when you're a journalist, I always regard myself as an arbiter for the public. It's my duty to ask the questions that the public would ask and to make sure that systems are all working transparently and properly. And Kimmage makes the point here, and it was the question that I was wondering about at the time as well, and that's why I didn't understand it was, Every year, the Irish Sports Council, or Sport Ireland as they are now, they bring out an anti-doping report, right? Mm. And I would have gone to all those anti-doping briefings and asked about every single mention, right? And they reported in 2016 that somebody had had a positive test for testosterone and been cleared. That was Garrett Turnbull.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. That wasn't Jamie Heaslip. There was no mention of that Jamie Heaslip case in that report. And so that's why, again, I asked my question, and the question I think that Kimmage would like to get answered is are people who are involved in team sport, is there a different protocol for them? Because why would that result not pop up? It should pop up naturally in the national report. Because everything pops up in national. If you fail, if an athlete fails a test for smoke and dope, it turns up in the national report. Yeah. Everything does. I remember a guy in Munster who came, a sub who came off the bench, had failed a test at one stage for cannabis, I think, or something. And I remember that came up in the report. Everything comes up in that report. Any failed test in Ireland, and yet that didn't come up in the report. So I just wondered why. Is there a different one rule for one?
The confusion in that as well, what Paul Kimmage is asking, he basically publishes a list of questions that he would have sent to Una May last week to ask about Jamie Heaslip's case. There's a long list of them, and one of them is basically who ordered the test.
Because
wondering, you know, the test had been taken at the Churchill Cup in the United States. So was this a USADA test?
Yeah.
Was this Irish Sports Council? And that's where there's even more confusion coming
but even
in
as if
well.
Even if it is a USADA test,
because he's
it would
he was
still
notified
be handled
by
the Irish Sports Council. Any anti-doping violation by an Irish athlete anywhere in the world, in any sport, would, in this case, an athlete based in Ireland, they would deal with any appeal. Mm-hmm. So I was just curious as to the handling of this. I thought it was unusual at the time. I thought it explains why Heaslip was such an extraordinary athlete, that he always lasted the full. I can't remember him ever being taken off a match. He had extraordinary endurance, and I thought, he's got a naturally high testosterone level. That's extraordinary. But I also wondered, why did that not pop up in the national anti-doping report, and how was it handled? And this is really what he's asking now, because Heaslip himself has raised it in his new autobiography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. And I'm sure there is going to be more on it from Paul Kimmage, because there are a lot of questions he's putting in it that he's making fairly clear he's waiting to get answers on. So I'm sure we're going to see even more on that as well. We probably have a little bit more time to get through a couple more pieces. What jumps out, guys? Are we talking tier two?
Tier two. We were saying yesterday. As if things weren't bad enough with the rugby yesterday, then there was a special Congress on rules. You know, there's nothing more. It's an even bigger horror show when you're sitting down talking about those. There's a few people who do good coverage of it today. Obviously, it was passed yesterday. The degree that it was passed, these new rules and creating a tier two in football only, we should stress, was 74% or something. It only needed 60%. So if people want to read up on that, the Indo, Dermot Crowe and also Philip Lanigan in the Mail on Sunday, they're both good on, and also Michael Foley in the Sunday Times. They all cover really what happened
yesterday, the full details
of it. But there are some interesting... First of all, it wasn't entirely boring and tedious as things often are, because the Antrim delegate, I thought, happened to be very witty. He was talking against it, but he was also quite witty. And the big argument, of course, is about the tier two, is that if you create tier two, are they going to get the same kind of coverage? Are they going to get promotion? Are they going to be played in Croke Park? Are they going to have all that? And Dermot Crowe's piece is very good, and he's very thorough in what happened yesterday. And he's talking about Kieran McCavanagh, who was the Antrim delegate, and he was saying they had all these promises about the Joe McDonagh Cup and how it was all going to happen. And he said, it's a great quote. He says, we were promised these TV rights, the sun, moon, and the stars. There's more coverage of Marty Morris's clothes than the McDonagh Cup on RT, so don't be deluding ourselves. And the Carlow delegate as well, is quoted as having the same thing. Sean Campion again, we've been promised there'll be all stars. We've been promised this stuff will happen, that there'll be support. But when it came down to it, he was arguing at Congress yesterday that this wouldn't happen. So that good stuff there. And Colm O'Rourke is good on it, making the point in the Indo as well about they've passed these new rules, and yet this review committee to review the rules and to review the systems, it isn't reporting until next month. I think the Cork chairperson raised that yesterday as well. So why
the
rush to put
your socks?
Yeah, absolutely. And why is this madness kind of being rushed through when this review committee could come up and have something completely different? So they all reflect that, and if MD wants to find out about what exactly happened, but again, this is a bit like what happened yesterday with the rugby team, and this one's going to run and run.
Yeah, there was a good quote as well from, you mentioned the Antrim chairman, Kieran McCavanagh, I think, was this talking about the coverage of Marty Morrissey's clothes rather than the Joe McDonagh. He also had a good line as well that he delivered. He says, people want to see their counties play against the top tier. People talk about the bottom 16. Folks, you need to have a reality check. There's a gap between the top four and the rest. If you imagine going into a sponsor and telling them you'll be playing in a competition that's most likely not going to get coverage, good luck with that. It does paint the reality and the picture that is facing a lot of counties now.
Yeah, and this new system, one of the things that people, and I, Sean, Colm O'Rourke talks about it here, one of the things that people were saying was, if you're going to create a second tier, surely if you create it, you have to give people the carrot of using it to get into the championship structure, the main structure, and they didn't pass that yesterday. So that's a question as well, as why bring in a second tier but still have no incentive to win it? Do you know what I mean? If winning it doesn't get you into an All-Ireland quarter-final or get you still there, you still possibly could have guys who, once they're knocked out of the championship and don't go into the qualifiers now, we'll just head to America anyway. So there's that whole area is there as well.
That quote there in that same article from the Antrim chairman, kids aspire to play at the top level. You know, that's quintessentially what it boils down to.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what GAA in general, that's what the ethos is. You know, kids want to play, emulate their county stars, you know, whether it's Meads, you know, against Carlow, or, you know, Antrim against Armagh, it doesn't matter. Like, it's kind of every team needs to have an opportunity, you know, to play against the best.
As obviously as well, going along with it, the other motion that was passed was to, it's going to be decided based on next year's league.
Yeah, where, so you, where you get, finish if, yeah, at the end of next year's
If you
league.
Get promoted into Division 2 from Division 3 next season, it means that you wouldn't be going into a B Championship if you were to fail to get into your provincial
right.
final. Dennis, as a Cork man,
yeah, are you exactly. That's glad really relevant
to see that Cork do. You know, Cork. If Cork get their promotion next year, thankfully it doesn't matter if they be
well,
carrier.
Well, we're always up and down, aren't we? So it'll kind of protect us a little bit, you think? I don't know.
It's funny. I heard Paul Kerrigan saying last week, and I think this is the really interesting question about special congresses and votes at GAA always, and probably in a lot of sports as well, is how much were the players consulted on this? Because I heard Paul Kerrigan actually being interviewed last week with Niall McNamee. Both of them asked, have you been asked about what you feel as players? And both of them said, no, we haven't.
And
that's
you,
the big question.
If you draw the similarity, I mean, this year we had the, you know, World Rugby trying to put together,
yes,
you know, the Global League.
Yeah.
It's quintessentially the same thing. Mm-hmm. The turning factor was that, you know,
the players
actually came together. So the International Players Association had a player council of about 50 players from around the world. And, you know, went to media with a statement. And, you know, it was fairly scathing, because in terms of, How do you put together a competition without asking
the biggest stakeholder in
the sport? They're the ones that are genuinely on the field and kind of, they're the ones that kind of will know the best formula in terms of creating a spectacle, but at the same time as well, it has to make sense.
And it has to motivate them.
It has to motivate.
Yeah.
And so if promotion relegation was one of the issues. So if the split and tears in this, if there's no promotion and relegation, you're going to lose that ethos.
And what I think is really interesting on us, the people who have been asking the players the question have probably been the journalists over the last year or two about their own thoughts on a B Championship. And what I found interesting is I've probably read as many interviews with players saying they do want a B Championship as I have with players saying they don't.
Yeah, there's
and
a real mix. There is a divide.
That's what's making it really tricky.
It is making it very tricky. And there is. And even the headline in the Indo now, it says, I don't know what the other ones are, two-tier format is passed with a mix of hope and fear.
Yeah.
And there is that thing of some people think it'll be a disaster. Some think people think it could change things and it could be positive. One thing, though, that definitely had popped up yesterday, and he did himself absolutely no favours, and that is that, like, we know this has been pushed through by John Horne, GAA president.
Yeah.
Like, he's been very proactive on this, and he has been directing it. But when it came, clearly yesterday he was asked at some point in it, how much promotion are we going to get for this, and you know, how's it going to happen? And he actually said that he had knowledge of a text message from RTE head of sport Declan McDennett, which indicated the second tier competition would receive live coverage. That to me is pretty, that's a pretty loose explanation. That is not engender great confidence.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm the president of the GA and I'm saying we have a text message. Surely you've signed, sealed and delivered. Certainly you would have had a meeting about it. And that's why there is that level of distrust, I think, amongst the grassroots, saying, you know, are you, how committed are you to this? Like, because the players, and as a journalist, I know that, we don't give Division 1, Division 2, Division 3 and Division 4. They don't get the same coverage. They're always pushed down to a few powers at the end, even during the league.
It's just a reality. It's just a reality.
And it's the same with All Ireland League rugby or whatever. Do you know what I mean? If it isn't getting the exposure and it doesn't get the exposure, it does get pushed aside. And so there's no prestige or as you say, there can be lack of motivation.
And again, like, there's that whole thing of how do you get better? How do counties get better? How do the provinces in Irish rugby get better? It's the more general population playing a sport or multiple sports at a younger age. So you kind of, if you're excluding them from having an input into the general evolvement and progression of a sport and the ideas and everything part of it, you're kind of losing such a big chunk of potential future stars.
Like I think it's clear there's a divide. I think that point about the divide is way higher up. There's a divide at the very top.
Yeah,
there's a serious divide there. There may be actually three divides in it. Do you know what I mean? The way it's going now. And they're trying something. But if that's the basis that you're saying there, you know, that's not very hopeful, or you know, you'd like to have something. So I think it's very much going to be suck it and see. And the irony is then we could have this fixtures review committee, our structural committee, come back. I think they're due to report in a month's time and say, well, actually, we're going to change the whole system. You know, there was a report in the Irish News last week, wasn't it, that they're talking about something completely different, a complete review of the GAA structure, so competitive structure, so it'll be interesting.
Yeah, and I'd say over the next few weeks, we're probably going to be reading more detail about it and more opinions on it. I think this weekend, it's the day after Congress. A lot of it is really just, here's the basic news of what actually happened yesterday.
Yeah, and then we should say the black cards and the sin bin and the kickouts and the advanced mark.
The
they were all passed as well.
Yeah. It's probably gone under the radar because the tier two, it's, you know, it's one of the biggest changes to the structure of the competition since it was ever formed.
And there's a big argument
about this sin bin is a big one.
At all levels.
It seems like it's a much more common sense approach to the black card.
It's definitely going to be more effective in terms of, because of those cynical fouls. You know, when someone's through on goal and you pull them down, you get a black card. You know, someone swapped in. Mm-hmm. You know, but you've already stopped the opportunity.
Yeah.
You know? I think they've seen that
there
works.
There has to be a consequence. You know, so now you lose a person. You know,
and bringing in the advanced mark is a really interesting one, because that actually could change. And could negatively change the way the game is played at club level yet as well. So all of that stuff we have to see how they work out. So, you know, I mean, sometimes people say that the GA, like, I think rugby is fascinating. Rugby is constantly changing. The argument even before this World Cup is it's changing too much and changing too much before a big major competition changes rules. The GA, at least, I think, are trying to change things. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that, you know, for a variety of reasons, including the dominance of Dublin probably in the last few years and things like that, is that there is a feeling that there is a huge divide in standards in the game, and how do we change that, and is it money that will change it as opposed to rule championship structures or rule changes? You know, is maybe investment in some places needed before all that? So that's what makes it such a fascinating area, I think. Yeah.
Kevin McStay, actually, even before we finish, like very briefly, he's doing an interview with Philip Lanigan, and he points out, you mentioned the imbalance, and you know, one of his suggestions is that the GAA itself appoints 32 individual county board CEOs themselves.
Yeah. Full-time professionals.
Yeah, full-time professionals.
Because not every county has one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's obviously an expensive idea, but the GAA, you would suspect anyway the GAA has the money to do something like that.
Yeah.
And who knows, that could go some way. You know, having someone in a smaller county who has a really good grasp of the commercial side of things, and you know, going going out and about sponsors, where a lot of county boards, they're just doing it with volunteers.
Well, and not only that, but the GAA itself at central level has had to intervene in county boards where they see that things aren't going well, you know. And on the player thing, actually, there was a good piece, I'm trying to remember, was it Dennis Walsh in Sunday Times, just talking about the player management and the Galway management.
Player grows.
Yes. But also about how, once again, county boards seem to have cocked up, if you like, in the appointment of management, and weren't talking to players who are centrally involved in this. And Joe Canning did the interview, and then they were saying, I think Galway have now taken on board and have talked to the players. But that's a whole thing about who's central, you know, what is the place of the player in these big decisions, apart altogether from commercial decisions, which can affect them as well. But that, I mean, that, Kevin McStay obviously has a book out, and his excerpts are being carried in the Mail on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And just for people who are buying papers today, and Owen Larkin, the Kilkenny hurlers, there's a very good excerpt from his book in the Sunday Inter today, so they have the rights to that, so people would be interested in those as well. Scathing on Cork, I'm not even going to go into the Kilkenny Cup, but anybody wants to read it, they'll have good fun reading that as well. And very good on how Brian Cody intervened and asked him and got him to reveal that he was suffering from depression, you know, and just a different side to Cody that we might have seen. Mm-hmm. And how subtly he did it. So those are interesting books, and this is time of year for books, so that was a good time.
All right, that's where we'll leave it this afternoon on the Sunday Papers. Thanks to Cleaner for coming in as always, and Dennis, your first go on the Sunday Paper Review. Thanks a million for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.